Thank you, Mr. Roop. And also thanks to Dr. Guy for the very beautiful music. I think we should spill things more often. That inspired the best singing. It was just beautifully done. Very inspiring. Soothing and inspiring all at the same time. Appreciate that a lot. Well, brethren, are there things that you absolutely hate? If we were to ask for what is one of your biggest pet peeves, I don't know what a pet peeve is, but I know the way my mother used to talk about it. It was something that irritated her. You know, my pet peeve is, and she would say whatever it was. You may have some pet peeves, since sometimes I'm out late visiting, helping people, stopping at the hospital, whatever it might be. One of my pet peeves is coming 2 a.m. to a red light, and there's no one else anywhere in sight. And to have to stop and sit there, I'll have to admit, I don't always sit there. Come on, the purpose of the red light is what? To help traffic flow smoothly and carefully. When there's nobody else around, it's just not necessary. So that's one of my pet peeves. Another one of my pet peeves is women who put makeup on while they're driving their car. That's one of my pet peeves. Now, everyone here is looking pretty guilty. I don't know what the deal is there. No, they're not. I mean, I have to hang up the phone and put down my hamburger to keep from hitting them. That's how angry I am at that point. How about hermetically sealed bags of cereal that you have to literally tear open and watch them splay all over the room just to get to the cereal? That's one of my... I mean, I understand packaging. Package it nicely, keep it fresh, but don't make it so tight. I was opening a Lar bar the other day, one of these granola bars. And it's like, who invented this package? King Kong cannot open this package. So I had to get his scissors out just to get a granola bar. Like, come on! Well, teasing aside, there are probably things that you really hate. I mean, you really hate with a passion. There's something I hate with a passion. It's called abortion. I mean, I hate that. To think that human beings are so cocky and so arrogant that they feel they have the right to rip a life out of a womb. That's something to hate. Child abuse, spouse abuse, elder abuse, war. I mean, we could make a list as long as your arm of things that are truly detestable that we can hate. Turn with me to Proverbs chapter 6 in verse 16. You probably know where I'm going. There's lots of things we can, for good reason, absolutely hate. Solomon includes, well, maybe David wrote it, but I'm guessing Solomon probably, a list of things that he says God hates. Now, I would think that some of the things we just mentioned might be on God's list as well. But Proverbs 6, beginning in verse 16, gives us some general categories, a short list, we might say, of things that God says he hates. We'll look at that list today to see what we might learn. Proverbs 6 and verse 16. These six the Lord hates. Now the word things is not technically in the Hebrew, although they are six things. We might call them categories. We might call them general approaches. These six things the Eternal hates. Yes, seven, it says, are an abomination unto him. Now the word hate, the Hebrew word sane, means exactly S-A-N-E in English. It's pronounced sane. It means exactly how we would understand the English word. It means to regard with a strong or passionate dislike. Another word is to detest. Now, if that's not strong enough, Solomon says, then these things are not just something God hates. They're an abomination to him. The Hebrew word toba means something disgusting, something detestable, an intense aversion, a shameful vice, an object to be abhorred, loathsome, odious. That's what an abomination is. God says he hates these things, he detests them. In fact, they are completely loathsome to him. Now, Moffat translates that God loathes these things. Today's English version, God cannot tolerate. New International, God cannot stand. New International, I should say, says detestable. New Century Version, cannot stand them. I can't stand this. Today we'll take a look at these things that God says he hates. Better understand why he considers these things abominations. Also helps us to see whether or not traces of these things abide in our hearts. And hopefully we'll be inspired to rid ourselves of the things that God actually hates. So what are the things that God hates? Six things the Lord hates. Seven are an abomination to him. Now, verse 17 lists the first one. A proud look. A proud look. Now for you and me, war is something to hate. A proud look? Other translations render this phrase haughty eyes. Haughty eyes. Can things be communicated with just the eyes? What's interesting in some psychological testing where people have trouble identifying or verbalizing their emotions, there is a panel of faces that are just round circles with eyes, and with eyebrows and with mouth, they are able to convey something like 60 different emotions just by a little bitty drawing. How many of you have used emoticons or emojis or whatever they call those little smiley faces? I mean, it's amazing with just those little bitty faces what you can communicate. Of course, if you don't have those little faces, you can make them up with parentheses and colons and dashes and things like this. It's amazing. But God says he hates haughty eyes. Haughtiness conveyed via a look. Why would God hate a proud look? Well, because of what it conveys. Underneath this look, to produce this look requires a proud, haughty, arrogant, rebellious, defiant attitude. That's what God hates. And it's expressed through those eyes. There's a phrase common in our language that we can relate to very well. You know exactly what I mean if I said, well, I was in this place and these other people were looking down on me. Now, you know I didn't mean I'm on the first floor and they're on the balcony looking down. You know what that means. They're looking down. They may not have said a word, but they can do the once over with the eyes. Ever been underdressed for an occasion and have someone never say a word, but just look at what you're wearing or what you're not wearing? A proud look. God hates this because of the pride behind it. The original sin was what? It wasn't the apple or the fruit in the Garden of Eden. It was the pride of Satan the devil. That was the first sin. God hates it because of what it produces. The same kind of pride that was behind this first recorded sin is present here. Pride that does not submit to God, that thinks it knows better, is better than God, has a better way, a better idea, will not submit. Turn over to, well, again, you might get your 3x5 card out. Stick it here in Proverbs 6 because we'll come back to this as we can through the sermon. But turn to Proverbs chapter 8. Proverbs 8 in verse 13. Proverbs 8 in verse 13. The fear of the eternal is to hate evil. If we really fear God, we're going to strive to hate evil. And then it goes on to say, pride and arrogance and the evil way. Those three things really are synonymous. Pride, arrogance, the evil way. See, pride and arrogance lead us to doing wrong things. And then he says, and the perverse mouth I hate. Now, is Solomon speaking for God, or is he also saying the same thing? We're not told here. In Proverbs 6, we're told this literally is what God hates. But we can all hate what that brings about. The New American Standard renders verse 13 this way. The fear of the eternal is to hate evil. Pride and arrogance and the evil way. And then it says this, and the perverted mouth I hate. Is it true that often the eyes speak volumes? Have you ever had one of your children speak to you with their eyes in a disrespectful manner? By showing you the whites as they roll them through their head? Isn't it interesting that when we try to help our children, let's say through discipline, isn't it interesting that what are we looking for as a result of discipline? We're looking for a humble set of eyes. That's what communicates to parents that you get this. You understand what I'm saying. You know how wrong that was. And when there's that steely, I'm not bending kind of a look, that communicates a lot. We're told to hate evil. What is listed first? Pride and arrogance. God says that this pride often makes itself evident through the eyes and through the mouth. So we examine ourselves to see how we are doing that way. Do we exhibit pride and arrogance through our mouth? Turn over to Ezekiel chapter 16. The book of Ezekiel chapter 16. And we'll read in verse 49 beginning. Ezekiel 16, in verse 49. The concept, or at least I should say the context here, is God correcting the nation of Israel's capital as a symbol for all of Israel. Samaria was the capital. So sometimes in prophetic or corrective verses, God will speak about Samaria or speak about the entirety of Ephraim with these key words. And in this case, the capital is identifying the entirety of the nation and their attitude. Notice this in verse 49. As I live, says the Lord Eternal, neither your sister Sodom... Wow. Your sister Sodom goes on to say, nor her daughters have done as you and your daughters have done. When we think about evil places, Sodom and Gomorrah kind of top the list. And God is saying, Jerusalem, Samaria, you are topping even them in evil. We don't think of that often. Your daughters have done worse than them. Verse 49. Look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had, what's listed first? Pride. We think of Sodom and Gomorrah as sexual sin being top of the list. That's not at God's top of the list. Those were terrible situations, without a doubt. But what brought about that behavior? What brought about that behavior was pride. Pride. We can do what we want. The proud look mentioned in Proverbs 6 lies behind this sin. Leads to all kinds of sinful acts. When we are our own authority, And it doesn't matter what God says, because our opinion is just as good as God's, if not better. Therefore, this pride leads to sin. So the sexual sins of Sodom and Gomorrah had their roots not in sex, but in pride. Because I'll do whatever I want. If it feels good to me, shut up, I'll do it. You can't tell me what to do. Pride brings about that kind of attitude. Now, you can have pride, but if you don't have wealth and time on your hands, you don't get to the level of debauchery that our culture has come to. She and her daughter had pride, number one, fullness of food, number two, and abundance of idleness. Too much time on my hands to follow perversions, unfortunately. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. You see, when you're involved in sexual sin, it's incoming. It's all about self, getting self-fulfillment, getting things for self, getting pleasure for self, or whatever. Not thinking about others. She did not strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. So they became completely self-focused. And verse 50 says, they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore I took them away as I saw fit. Pride was the issue. Pride and arrogancy let them define for themselves what was right and wrong, and led them to all kinds of perversions. So God says, Judah, Israel, Jerusalem, you're no better than that. In fact, you've done worse. Notice down in verse 56. In verse 56, for your sister Sodom was not a byword in your mouth in the days of your pride. Like, you didn't think about what they went through. You didn't think about why they were taken out. It was because of the pride. Pride that leads to that kind of sin. New International Version translates verse 56 this way. You would not even mention your sister Sodom in the day of your pride. Oh, that won't happen to us. You see, Israel and Judah had this concept that God is with us. He won't allow us to fall the way others have. Sad to say that our culture today has come to this same spot. The pride and the arrogance that our nation expresses is similar to that expressed in Sodom and Gomorrah. Similar to what was expressed in Samaria. Similar to what was expressed in Jerusalem. God, you're not going to tell us what to do. We'll define what is right behavior. We'll not accept your definition. We won't accept your word. Now, we can be surprised today in one sense. People don't accept God's word, but that's been the case for Israel for a long, long time. God gets angry about pride because it takes us down a long and winding road to absolute destruction. What was Satan's sin? Sin of pride. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. We'll read verses 5 and 6 here. Pride is so difficult to get a handle on. Remember one cartoon that I saw a number of years ago was a man sitting at his pastor's desk. And his pastor was saying, well, that's quite a dilemma that you covet my humility. Well, I want to be humble, but I'm coveting to be humble. Well, then it's a wrong desire. It's because I want to look humble, not because I really want to be humble. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verses 5 and 6. Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Conversion, by the way, is an attitude of submission. Plain and simple. When we lose that attitude of submission, conversion goes out the door and all kinds of problems settle in to people's lives and into the church. Yes, all of you be submissive one to another. Be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud. He hates pride. He hates for us to look down on others, to see them as inferior or useless or poor or bad or unacceptable. He resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. We all desire God's graciousness to be applied to us. So we want to exude humility. We want to see ourselves as we really are, as we truly are. We want to have that perspective, not lifted up. We're told in Romans not to think, woe to those who think too highly of themselves, higher than themselves than they ought, as King James says. God resists the proud. He gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time. Knowing our position in the family of God is an incredible gift, a very important thing to do. God resists the proud and always will, right into the lake of fire. That's where the prideful will end up. Those who will not repent of that pride will end up in the lake of fire. So the challenge for us is to draw close enough to God to take on godly humility, the kind of humility that Jesus Christ exuded every single day and still does. The opposite of pride, the opposite of a proud look, is a deeply humble spirit. Don't we say that sometimes humble people look at their shoes a lot? Their eyes are down? Certainly true. And we're not saying that we all go around looking at our shoes. What we'll usually see is shoes that should have been polished and probably weren't. But it's an attitude of heart. Instead of looking one in the eye with a resistant spirit, it's a deeply humble spirit. Let's go back to Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6. Now, we could spend an entire sermon, I think, on each one of these. We won't. We'll touch the highlights. Second thing God says He hates in verse 17 after a proud look, Proverbs 6, verse 17, is a lying tongue. Excuse me. A lying tongue. God hates a lying tongue because lies destroy the very foundation of truth. God is truth. We're told that it's impossible for God to lie. He hates lying because it's so destructive. It destroys trust. It destroys confidence. It destroys faith. With lying, there's nothing consistent. There's no absolutes. There's nothing can be relied on. There's nothing for sure. God is a for sure God. You can depend on everything He says. If He says everything happens for our good, that's the truth. We may not see it just yet, but it's true. Turn to Psalm 52. Again, we'll come back to Proverbs 6 in a little while. Psalm 52. In the first four verses, speaks about lying here. I think you might say that speaking of a kind of lying that's addictive and can become habitual. Psalm 52 in verse 1. Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? The goodness of God endures continually. Your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You love evil more than good, lying rather than speaking righteousness. You ever ask ourselves, why do we lie? Why do we lie? Well, sometimes we lie to spare other people's feelings. We might refer to those as white lies. Someone says, what did you think about, and you fill in the blank, you know, whatever it might be, and you know it's ridiculous, but you kind of say, well, that's interesting. Don't know quite what it was. We lie to spare people's feelings. It's not right. It's a lie. Now we have to learn to be diplomatic and kind and loving and those things, but it is a lie. Sometimes we lie to make ourselves look better. We lie to make ourselves feel better. We make a lie to make ourselves sound righteous. And it is a temptation to garnish everything that we say with a lie, or a partial lie, we might say, because truth just doesn't sound good enough anymore. Or truth may be somewhat harsh. Well, God doesn't think that way. Speak the truth in love, we're told. Continuing on in verse 4, you love all devouring words, you deceitful tongue. Wow. God hates lying because of what it accomplishes, what it does, how it hurts us and others. Turn over a few psalms to Psalm 109. Psalm 109. We'll read the first three verses here. There's an interesting concept here in this portion. That lying may have an underlying component of hatred. To me, that's fascinating. Psalm 109, verse 1. Do not keep silent, O God of my praise, for the mouth of the wicked and the mouth of the deceitful have opened against me. Deceitfulness. Sometimes we lie, deceive others. Whenever the intent is to deceive, it's probably not truth. It's probably causing troubles. They've opened against me. They've spoken against me with a lying tongue. It's almost like the tongue has a life of its own. James 3, we're all familiar with that. Kind of speaks that way. Verse 3, they've surrounded me with words of hatred and fought against me without a cause. Think about that. Is it possible that lies actually have an underlying component of hatred? No, I'm lying because I love this person. I want to spare their feelings. That's actually hatred. How can you say that? Well, because we don't love them enough to tell them the truth, to really and truly help them. To spare one's feelings in our culture has become one of the touchstones. Well, we don't want to hurt their feelings. Well, if our child is heading toward the railroad tracks and a speeding train is going to come, we want to hurt their feelings or they're going to be killed. So it should be pretty obvious. But if we're not striving to be completely truthful as God is, we're not striving to be like God. God doesn't lie to make us feel better. He tells us the truth because he knows then we will be better. That's what we want to try to accomplish. So we shortchange others when we lie, and it means we're not loving them as we should. We shortchange them. Maybe this is the door God is opening for them to truly learn something that's of great value to them and to improve them into the future. And if we gloss it over with a lie, we're actually hating them. It's a lack of love. So lying sometimes has an underlying component of actually hating others, not loving them the way that we should, to want to see them truly improve. Remember a situation probably 25 years ago where a person came and they were going to do music. And they played the guitar and they sang, and it sounded a little bit like stepping on a cat's tail. The saddest thing to me, as you have to sit and explain, we really appreciate your effort, but it's really not something we could use, and here's why. The saddest thing to me is that nobody in their background had sat them down at some point and said, sweetheart, this is just not you. We got to work on some other talents and abilities here, because this one just is not one that you have ability in. So all these months and years, since nobody had done that, they assumed that they were just the cat's meow instead of the cat's scream. But nobody had the courage to simply say, that's just not good. It's kind of, oh, yeah, whoa, keep going, guitar and singing and wow. You know, somebody please sit down and say, this is just not good. Nice try, but this is not where some of your skills are. Let's work on developing something else. Now, that's not to say skills and talents can't be developed, but there's sometimes somebody just had to be honest and say, that's terrible. That was not good. Here's the pitch, and here's where you are. You know, this is not where we need to be. So, again, showing them love would not have spared their feelings at that point, but it would have been something that would have been much easier early on than much later. Turn to Proverbs chapter 26. Proverbs chapter 26. A lying tongue, God says He absolutely hates. James says that in God is the truth. There's no shadow. His light is no shadow of turning. There's never a time that God doesn't speak the truth. And again, it's in love, as we strive to do. We strive to handle those awkward situations in as loving a manner as we can. But they have to be dealt with. Proverbs 26 in verse 28. A lying tongue hates those who are crushed by it. Now, this seems to talk about those who deliberately lie about others to destroy them. That lying tongue hates those who are crushed by it. So to deliberately lie about others, to put them down, to raise the self up is just dastardly. Now it says a flattering mouth works ruin. And again, flattering is a whole different story in that sense. A flattering tongue is to gain selfish advantage by buttering up, as we say, someone else. Although in today's health-conscious society, it must maybe olive oiling someone up instead of buttering them up. The point is, you make them think wonderful things about you because you're so complimentary, and then they want to give you things or do things for you. Flattery is a different story. Lying, we're told, hates those who it crushes. So when we think about lying as hatred, it can give us some motivation to really strive to examine our speech and what we say and the motivation for which we're saying it. Are we lying to hurt others? Are we lying to spare them when they really need to hear the truth from someone kind and gentle? Are we lying for selfish advantage? Are we lying so that we don't look bad? God says He hates it because of its destructive capacity. Turn to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. We'll begin reading in verse 23. Ephesians 4 and verse 23. And be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man. So we draw close to Christ. We receive God's Spirit. We work to have that Spirit grow. Be renewed in the spirit of your mind. That you put on the new man, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. That's what we all desire. We want to be the new man, not the old man. And then in verse 25, the rest of verse 24, created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. If we want to be truly righteous and holy, what do we have to do? Verse 25, therefore, put away lying. To me, it's interesting that God, when He talks here, inspires the Apostle Paul to write, if we want to be in true righteousness and holiness, the first thing we have to do is quit lying. Forsaking lying can be done through the power of God's Holy Spirit working in us. I don't know that we'll ever do it perfectly. Truthfulness is what God desires. Truthfulness. It will greatly benefit us personally, greatly benefits all those around us. To be in true righteousness and holiness, verse 25, put away lying. Let each of you speak with his neighbor truth, for we are members one of another. Again, we're tied together. When I lie to you, it hurts everybody. When you lie to me, it hurts everybody. It hurts the foundations of truth. So we want to be one striving to speak the truth, to support truth in every aspect. We want to be completely truthful. Before we ever hit the share button on Twitter or Facebook about something, we want to be sure it's right, it's true. We don't want to be spreading things that are untrue. So rather than just, oh, that's terrible, click forward. It could have been years since this thing first made an appearance on the internet, and we're forwarding something that's maybe completely patently false. You don't seem to get quite as much of those anymore, but everyone's sort of, look at what terrible thing is happening here, click. And somebody shares it with hundreds of other people, and you find out it's an absolute, it's just not true. So, a lying tongue. God says He just hates breaking the foundation of truth, the solidness of truth, the dependability of truth. So we want to strive to have a truthful tongue as opposed to a lying tongue. Let's go back to Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6 just finished the first two-thirds of verse 17. There's a third thing that God hates listed in verse 17. That is, hands that shed innocent blood. Hands that shed innocent blood. Now, the obvious application is clear, that this is an abhorrence of the attitude that has no regard for human life, or little regard to human life. So, we would certainly say, without a doubt, in my opinion, one of the things we mentioned in our introduction fits under this category. Abortion is shedding innocent blood. It's taking, it's stealing a life. That's wrong. It's sinful. It's murder. So the obvious application is that when we have so little regard for human life that we will take that gift from God and trash it, it's obviously wrong. One that kills indiscriminately. One who kills innocent bystanders who are not guilty of anything but being in the wrong time at the wrong place. The wrong place at the wrong time. That's ghastly. So whether it's a high school or a movie theater or a college campus or a church, that kind of thing is just absolutely abhorrent to God. He hates to see it. It shows a person has nothing of God's mind. He does not value the potential that God places in each person, does not understand at all that we are made in the image of God, and therefore every human life is of value and worth, and should be respected and honored because they're made in the image of God. They have the potential to be in God's very family. Hands that shed innocent blood, God detests. Turn over to Ezekiel chapter 9. Ezekiel chapter 9. We're familiar with this, so we'll cut into the middle of the context just to pick out this verse. Ezekiel 9 and verse 4. We'll read verse 3 for just a little bit of background. The glory of the Lord of Israel, the God of Israel, had gone up from the cherub where it had been to the threshold of the temple. So the picture is, you're there in the city of Jerusalem. God's presence is there at the temple. And he called to the man clothed with linen, to this angel, who had the writer's inkhorn in his side. In verse 4, the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city and through the midst of Jerusalem. Put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. The reason we read that is simply to remind ourselves that we cannot afford to become calloused to the kind of gut-wrenching shedding of innocent blood that goes on day in and day out in our world. It has been the history of human beings to kill one another. From the very beginning, the first family had a murderer in the family and a murderer in the family. So to say it's getting worse may be true. At the same time, it's not as bad as it has been yet. the violence, the shedding of innocent blood got so bad during the time of Noah that God said, I'm done. I'm done. And he destroyed it all, with the exception of Noah and his family. There is coming a time when God will say, I'm done. And the great tribulation and the day of the Lord will ensue. And a greater destruction than the flood will take place. Or at least as great a destruction, certainly a much more powerful one. So we must not let our compassion get fatigued. We need to sigh and cry for those innocents that have been killed. Now again, we could look at many, many examples of that in individual situations, but then we have entire nations involved in shedding innocent blood. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy that our world suffers from. So we must sigh and cry. We must detest hands that shed innocent blood the way God does. Those who take advantage of the weak. It's a ghastly thing. Turn to Isaiah chapter 59. Isaiah 59. We live in a world where the strong abuse the weak. It's simply the way it is. It is Satan's nature to take advantage of those who are weaker, to take from those who are weaker. God says he hates that. Isaiah 59 and verse 1 says this, Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened, we're encouraged by that it cannot save, nor his ears heavy that it cannot hear. We're delighted with that. But, he's talking to Israel, your iniquities have separated you from your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you, so they'll not hear. God's hands are not short, his ears are not plugged, but you put up a barrier. Verse 3 says, For your hands are defiled with blood. Sin in general covers our hands with blood. When we take advantage of the weak, we're shedding innocent blood, figuratively. God hates that. What does he ask of us? He asks us to care for the weak, not take advantage of them. He asks us to help the simple, not steal from them. And yet, you probably get calls every day, like I do, from crooks who are trying to steal from the simple. I got a call recently from the IRS saying that I was going to be taken to court for an IRS violation. And if I didn't call this number and make a payment, I was going to be going to jail. Some dirty rat is constantly calling people, trying to take advantage of them. It was just a lie. The IRS is going to call, leave a message on my machine saying I'm going to take you to court and put you in jail. Excuse me? You dirty, rotten liar. And I've talked to others who've gotten the same call. I know one individual who paid thousands of dollars. She happened to be an over 90-year-old woman who received this frightening call, similar to this one, not the IRS scam, but another one. Paid money. I'm sorry, that's not quite enough yet. Dirty, filthy rat stealing from people. God hates that. That's shedding innocent blood. That's stealing this poor old woman's life savings. She had to move out of where she was into a family's home to be taken care of for the rest of her life. It's ghastly. To take advantage of the weak is wrong. It's hands that shed innocent blood. Your hands are defiled with blood, verse 3 says, and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies. Your tongue has muttered perversity. It's just the way it is. Take advantage of the weak. No one calls for justice, verse 4, nor do they plead for truth. They trust in empty words and speak lies. They conceive evil and bring forth iniquity. They hatch viper's eggs and weave the spider's web. He who eats of their eggs dies, and from that which is crushed, a viper breaks out. There's nothing good there. So while we might not be guilty of shedding innocent blood in the sense of a murder, when we defame someone, when we speak evil of them, in essence, we're shedding blood. Shedding innocent blood. God says He will take vengeance. He'll repay. It's not ours to do that. We might say, well, they really did something wrong, so I have every right to speak about them. Not necessarily. Not necessarily at all. Let God handle those things. So the way we treat our mate or our family member could be endearing, loving, kind, gentle, or we can shed innocent blood. We can hurt them greatly, causing anguish because of the way we've shredded them. So any form of taking advantage of the helpless is a form of shedding innocent blood. Guilty of hurting people when we should be helping people. So it is possible to be one who sheds blood. 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. We'll read verse 8. 1 Peter 3 and verse 8. We see very much an opposite attitude. From the shedding of innocent blood, finally, after Peter talks to husbands and wives about their attitudes, verse 8 says, finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Having compassion for, that's the opposite of hands that shed innocent blood. Striving for compassion, asking God for a soft heart, asking God to truly be moved by those scenes of the strong taking advantage of and harming the weak, that they really hurt us, that we really feel for them, instead of suffering from compassion fatigue. Finally, all of you be one mind, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing. Knowing that you are called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. When we're able to give, when we should, in the world's eyes, be taking, God says He'll bless us. He'll take care of that. We want to build others. We want to be tender-hearted, courteous, never returning evil for evil. We don't want to be guilty of hands that shed innocent blood, something that God hates. Well, with that, brethren, we've been through three of the things that God hates. We could go through more, but what we're going to do is take a break there for 2 weeks, and then we'll come back and cover the others that God describes. So what I would suggest at this point is let's do what we can to be sure that, number one, our eyes are humble, that, number two, our tongue speaks things of purity, and that our hands are completely pure and clean as well. And we'll come back next time to discuss numbers 4, 5, 6, and 7.